When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hello and welcome to the latest episode of Battleground with me, Patrick Bishop, and Saul David. We're taking a bit of a back seat this week and letting our guests do most of the talking. We're very lucky to have on the show the historian and journalist Katia Hoyer. Katia is the author of two outstanding books on German history, Blood and Iron, about the German Empire from 1871 to 1918, and Beyond the Wall, the history of East Germany, where she was born. Katia will be enlightening us on a subject that's become even more important in the light of the revelation that Russian intelligence penetrated a high-level German military discussion on sending Taurus long-range cruise missiles to Ukraine. And that subject is, what on earth is Germany up to, and will it be a reliable partner as the conflict develops?
But before that, we're going to talk about an alarming bit of news that broke midweek. That was that a Russian missile landed just 500 meters from President Zelensky while he was meeting the Greek Prime Minister Kyriakos Mitsotakis in the port city of Odessa. They were unharmed, though the strike did kill five people. Russia says the missile was aimed at a hangar in the port housing sea drones that have been causing havoc amongst the Russian Black Sea Fleet recently, including another $65 million patrol ship with an attack helicopter on board that was sunk this week. Nonetheless, the strike on Odessa does raise lots of awkward questions, not least what would have happened if Zelensky or indeed Mitsotakis had been taken out. The consequences might have been pretty dire, don't you think, Patrick?
Yeah. I mean, was it an assassination attempt? We'll probably never know. My feeling is it probably wasn't, and was, as for once, as stated by the Russian spokesman. But you're absolutely right. Zelensky's an essential part of the Ukrainian war effort, isn't he, Saul? He plays a role that equates historically, I would say, to that played by Winston Churchill in Britain's war, that is, stiffening backbones, inspiring a spirit of resistance, and generally driving the war effort on. And so without him, I think there'd be disorder, to say the least, at the top. There's no obvious political successor, and it would be easy to imagine a power struggle between the likes of the recently deposed armed forces chief Valery Zaluzhny and his replacement Oleksandr Sirsky, and possibly the intelligence chief Kirillo Budanov as well, all of whom appear to have some sort of political ambitions. Now, this is at the very worst time in the war. There's a lot of depressing news coming in from the east. You know, Russia is slowly making advances. They may just be tactical advances, but it's certainly sowing a spirit of, I won't say panic, but certainly alarm in the villages and towns in the firing line, those quite close to the front line, apparently are emptying out. But what about if Mitsotakis had been killed, Saul? Greece is a NATO country. How do you think the West would have reacted to his death?
Well, there would have been shock and alarm. But, you know, frankly, Patrick, this was not an attack on Greece. It was a missile fired into Ukraine in the midst of a war. And if, like Mitsotakis, you're visiting, you take your chances, in my view. Having said all of that, to think that there's going to be a united response from NATO or even the EU is a bit optimistic. It's unlikely to speak with one voice. It's effectively war by committee, which is never ideal. The most bullish response, given what's happened in the last week or so, is likely to come from Macron, who, in stark contrast to Germany's reluctance to up the ante in the war, is doubling down on his recent remarks, suggesting that the time may come when NATO boots hit the ground in Ukraine.
Yeah, it's fascinating, isn't it? I mean, he didn't row back from that, which, given the sort of response he got, not just from allies, but also inside his own country, from his own military, who are a bit dubious about the prospect. But instead of that, he's actually still talking tough. He had a meeting the other day in Prague with the president of the Czech Republic, and he urged Ukraine's allies to stand firm in its support for Ukraine. He said He fully stood behind the remarks he'd made the previous week about not ruling out the deployment of Western troops. And he went on to say, "We are surely approaching a moment for Europe in which it will be necessary not to be cowards." Quite strong stuff. Now, he was meeting his Czech counterpart, Petr Pavel, who's a military man, former general, one-time chair of the NATO Military Committee, and he himself is a staunch supporter of Ukraine. So Macron asked, "Is this or is it not our war? Can we look away in the belief that we can let things run their course? I don't believe so, and therefore I called for a strategic surge, and I fully stand behind that. We want no escalation. We've never been belligerent." So he's being a bit contradictory and also a bit vague, isn't he, Saul? It still sounds, I think, rather than like a concrete proposal, a bit of a face-saving exercise following those negative remarks from his fellow Western leaders.
Yeah, and it quickly got another rebuff, probably not surprisingly, from Germany's defense minister, Boris Pistorius, who said Macron's quotes were not helpful. And I quote, "We don't need really, from my perspective at least, discussions about boots on the ground or having more courage or less courage." Pavel, who's always been staunch in his support for Ukraine, as you say, Patrick, was a bit more helpful. He said that though the West would not cross the, and I quote, "imaginary red line" by getting involved in combat operations, he did suggest that NATO countries could, for instance, train Ukrainian soldiers in Ukraine, which would be, in his view, no violation of international rules. The two were meeting to discuss a Czech plan to buy ammunition for Ukraine outside Europe. Macron said France backed the plan and also supported using earnings from frozen Russian assets in Europe to fund Ukraine's defense while not touching the capital.
But all of this highlights the different approaches that European states are taking to the crisis, doesn't it? And in particular, the rift that seems to be opening between the more aggressive approach being championed by Macron and the deep misgivings that appear to be felt at the top in Germany about provoking Putin and triggering some escalation of the conflict that would directly impact the country. The German attitude sometimes seems hard to understand, but to help shed some light on its complexities, we're joined by Katja Hoyer, who grew up in East Germany before moving to Britain, where she's a visiting fellow at King's College London. She's just returned from a trip to Germany. Katja, this story of the Russians listening in to a 38-minute long conversation between senior generals about the deployment or not of long-range German Taurus cruise missiles to Ukraine is really quite extraordinary, isn't it? Tell us more about it and what's being said about the leak in Germany.
Yeah, so the sort of hoo-ha around it was caused by the fact that you basically had senior military personnel discussing not only whether or not it's a good idea to send those missiles to Ukraine, but also what targets could be hit by them. And therefore, you know, that's quite a strategic decision, not just, you know, whether to send sort of weapons that go a step up from what has been sent, but actually you're kind of encouraging Ukraine, you know, to go for targets that previously Germany hasn't been all that keen on encouraging Ukraine to do. So that in particular is the Crimean Peninsula that's been discussed, you know, that the bridge had been or could be a target with the Taurus missiles. So because that's a discussion that's obviously quite sensitive and also quite a fundamental decision to make, in the fact that this has been not just sort of, you know, recorded by the Russians, but then actually sort of played back for the world to hear, was obviously quite an embarrassment to the German politicians and to the German military, but also the fact that, you know, this brought home to the German people, really, that these things had been discussed behind closed doors. So there's been quite a big debate around that in Germany. I've just come back from there, and that is something that isn't just discussed in the media and by politicians, but really at, you know, the dinner table and people's families as well.
Well, we'll come on to that and what people are saying. But just in the immediate, does that mean that Taurus is now off the table? Is it now impossible, do you think, for Germany to deploy these missiles to, or rather hand them over to Ukraine?
Well, I think there's been quite a sort of clear line on that from the government, in that there's reluctance to do just that. But I think in a way the leak could almost backfire, in the sense that all the discussions one didn't want to have in public are now out there anyway. And the way that the Russian sort of propaganda has since been scaled up, you know, in terms of kind of saying that the Germans are planning to use them, and they're, you know, they're scaling up their own efforts to support Ukraine with that. That could, in a way, almost backfire in the sense that it's brought that discussion into the German public, whether the government wants to or not, and in a way that, you know, means that basically the message is almost out there already, the kinds of things that the government didn't really want to talk about.
Katie, we're slightly mystified with this whole business of caution around Taurus for the obvious reasons that we've sent storm shadows. The French have sent scalp, effectively the same thing. And they are being used in all Ukrainian territory that is under Russian occupation, including the Crimea. So what is this concern that Germany has that Crimea is somehow separate from the rest of what it would consider to be Ukraine's sovereign territory?
Well, there are many people in Germany, and surveys always show that that's quite a widespread belief, that this war can't be won outright in a military sense, but that there has to be some sort of negotiation. And I think people feel that Crimea should be part of that and should be reserved almost as a bargaining chip, really, to say, you know, this is a way to end the war eventually. And I think that's such a widespread belief that at the moment, you kind of take that off the table by giving Taurus to Ukraine and say, you know, go for it and capture that back. That makes that negotiation line very difficult. And I think this is something that people are quite wary about. I think a lot of that is historical reasons. So there's a sense that because of the Second World War and the way that the Soviet Union and Germany were fighting on the kind of most devastating theater, really an existential war against one another at that point, that of course Germany had launched, that this shouldn't be repeated, so that Germany shouldn't go to war with Russia again. And I think the kind of psychological component of that shouldn't be underestimated. You see that immediately as well in the Russian output, you know, the way that they talk again of sort of denazifying not just Ukraine, but Europe, trying to play into the same tropes. And they know perfectly well that that will find some reception in Germany as well, where the skeptics will say that's exactly right. You know, we can't kind of repeat the Nazi crimes of the past by attacking what is now seen as kind of Russian territory since 2014. So I think that just adds a new dimension to the discussion in Germany and this sort of quasi mythical almost relationship that Germany has with Russia and has done for decades.
Yeah, it's a huge paradox, isn't it, Katya? You've got, by doing this, I mean, from our perspective, you're actually allowing the Russians to behave like Nazis. So it's a very, very complex one. And as you say, obviously digs deep into the memory of the Second World War. But to go back to what you're saying about this being now a public discussion, just from what you've heard, are people more or less sympathetic to Ukraine as a result of this kerfuffle?
That really and completely depends who you ask.
Of course.
I find it's particularly strong support for Ukraine, mostly in the cities, more among certain elements of the sort of middle classes, more in the left-leaning, and I mean by that sort of liberal left-leaning, as in Green supporters, for example, or people who support the Liberal Party, there you'll find stronger support for this. If you go further left, in the sort of traditional left, then you'll find more sympathy towards, not necessarily outright sympathy towards Russia, but towards what people would call a kind of diplomatic peace solution, by which they mean kind of forcing Ukraine into conceding territory in exchange for peace. And then as you mentioned at the beginning, I come from East Germany, and there's a particularly ambivalent relationship to Russia, where many people feel they have a closer relationship to it because of the, you know, very close relationship of the Soviet Union to the GDR, to East Germany, and the fact that therefore many people, you know, went to Moscow to study, say, for example, have read Russian literature when they were at school. I still learned Russian at school. You know, this kind of is something that lingers for a long time, and that closer relationship, I think, also means that people are more willing to sort of say, you know, there should be some sort of negotiated peace rather than an outright military victory. So I would say it's a really big topic in Germany that people are discussing with some heat as well. And that's also caused the political parties to be quite clear on how they position themselves. I mean, some of them are divided, like within the SPD, for example, you find a whole, that's the Social Democratic Party, you find a whole kind of range of political opinions in there. But say, for example, in the leadership of the Greens, they're very hawkish, which is quite a turnaround from where they've come from. So it is something that's really, you know, intensely debated, and there isn't a clear line, I would say, where you can say this is how the German public feels about it.
I mean, it's an extraordinary situation we've got now, Katia, where Germany is the, apart from the America, and the taps have been turned off there, possibly temporarily, who knows for how long, but Germany is now the biggest provider of military support for Ukraine, and yet it keeps on insisting on these lines that it doesn't want Ukraine to cross. And one of them, as you've just pointed out, is attacking targets in Crimea. I've already explained why we find that mystifying. I sort of get your historical argument for it. It's a much sounder one than the military one. I mean, in the end, Crimea is being used to supply as a method of bringing in weapons, which is putting pressure on Ukraine's front line. And if Germany doesn't want that line to move closer to Kyiv, the best thing it can do is give Ukraine the weapons it needs to prevent that from happening. So it's a really contradictory position. I understand there's a difficulty there, but do you see any possibility that, as Patrick asked before, that Germany is going to be moving its position on this, at least officially at government level?
Well, I think the problem that Germany has had from the beginning is that it hasn't been clear on how it wants this war to end. There isn't a clear line, especially not in the coalition government. I mean, it's easy to forget that Germany is run by three political parties and that the opposition is now actually much stronger in terms of public support than the government itself, if you will. They would only get something like a third of the vote now. So because of that, there's never been from the chancellor or from the government overall a kind of line where they say, we want an outright military victory, or we think there ought to be a negotiated peace at some point, or whatever they want out of it. It isn't clear. And I think as a result of that, you get this muddled policy, really, where a lot of weapons are being sent, a lot of money is being spent. But at the same time, every time, you know, they're supposed to kind of take a step further towards supplying Ukraine with new things, the same debate comes up again, and people say, you know, some people want them to win outright. Other people say, no, that's not the way forward because it bars the way to negotiated peace. And I think because of that, you don't really get a clear sense of strategy from Germany. And I'm not convinced that this current debate, you know, kind of takes away from that. So, whether or not to send Taurus missiles is kind of one of those milestones, really, where they'd have to decide what they actually want out of it, and that's not happening. So I'm not sure whether or not the German government might eventually be bounced into doing this. I doubt it, because the surveys that have just come out on this show that the majority of Germans, or they indicate that at least, don't seem to want that. So they will feel that there isn't public pressure to do so from within Germany, with most of the other allies being distracted by them, you know, by their own political domestic situation. So we might have elections coming up in this country, in the UK very soon. Obviously, the US are, you know, having their own domestic political situation with elections coming up. You know, in Germany, there's local elections coming up soon. I'm not sure that they will feel that there's enough concerted pressure from the outside or the inside to change their minds on this. There's currently no reason for Scholz to say, you know, I'm going to change my mind on it.
Katia, what's been the reaction to the very gung-ho posture that Macron has been striking in France?
I think there was a feeling that, you know, similar to other things that have happened, like, you know, sort of Scholz talking about ground support from the UK and France. I think there's just a general feeling that there's no coordination between European allies on this, and that's creating a sort of embarrassing chaos. So I'm not sure that's entirely directed against Macron as such, but there just seems to be a feeling that Germany's relationship to France is at a difficult juncture at the moment, to say the least. That was quite embarrassing, though, the visit that Scholz had made, you know, to the meeting of European leaders, because effectively Scholz and Macron were saying opposite things in very brief succession. And I think that in general leads to a sense that there isn't a concerted and coordinated effort from people who are supposed to be close allies. So I think that's how that was received, rather than specifically saying kind of Macron's gone too far here. I think there was more of a sense that they should have talked to each other to find a clear line to pull together.
Thanks so much, Katia, for taking the time.
Yeah, no worries.
Okay, that was great. Well, do join us in part two when we've got another fascinating contribution on another crucial aspect of the war, and that's Ukraine's ability to put soldiers in the field. Guy Walters, also a historian and journalist, has recently visited a UK base where, under Operation Interflex, Ukrainian troops are receiving NATO training before being sent to the front lines. He'll be telling us what he saw and heard, and we'll also be doing our best to answer your questions.
Welcome back. Ukraine's manpower problems are now a huge issue in the fight, with images of press gangs grabbing people off the street to force them into uniform. Well, there are plenty of young men and women who are prepared to fight, and our friend Guy Walters recently visited a UK base where, under Operation Interflex, they're receiving accelerated training before returning home and heading to the front lines. This is what he told us.
So, Guy, with your journalist's hat on, you've recently been on a trip to Ukraine.
So two different hats I've been wearing in relation to Ukraine over the past 2 weeks. The journalistic hat, I went to a place in southern England where young Ukrainians are being trained by the British Army as part of, as I'm sure many listeners know, something called Operation Interflex, that gives young Ukrainian recruits, or even old Ukrainian recruits, I mean, people as old as you and me, 5 weeks of the infantry training redux. I went and spoke to some of them, and then with another hat on, which is not something that I sort of do that often, I'm afraid, it was a charitable hat. A friend and I drove a van full of medical equipment and supplies to Ukraine. So we drove the van to an unnamed Polish border town where the medicine is stored in an unnamed type of building. and then we walked across the border and we met quite a few Ukrainian recruits who had just come back from Britain, coincidentally. So I've had some interaction there. So shall I talk a bit about what I saw in southern England on Interflex?
Yeah, please.
Well, what was really fascinating was I was writing a piece of The Independent about what happens on these training camps in the UK. I mean, so far we have trained, by Valentine's Day, I think the number was 34,284 Ukrainians in Britain. And this isn't just a UK operation. You know, there are 12 different countries training the Ukrainians, but mostly in 7 locations in Britain. And, you know, so you've got Aussies there. You've even got Kosovans training Ukrainians. And so it's a really group effort. And certainly the young recruits I saw, one was 21, one was 23, so they are young, and you guys will know more about the policy about age and recruitment. They looked tired because they were 4 weeks into the 5-week thing, and we worked these men and young women really hard. And they were tired, tense, and determined. You know, it wasn't like talking to a bunch of squaddies who are all larking around and having a smoke and a fag. You know, these young people know that they are going to be on a front line within 2 to 3 weeks of me talking to them. And it made me feel very small. And any question you kind of asked about how they were feeling or blah, 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 just felt sort of crass. And I think it would be fair to say, you know, they already sort of had that kind of 1,000-yard stare, that sort of cliched image of the soldier. You know, they looked nervous, but at the same time, and they would have said this, wouldn't they? But they did say they felt very prepared by what the British had done with them. You know, when they arrive, they get given, you know, they've been a hairdresser in, you know, Kyiv, you know, 2 days before. The next thing they know, they're landing somewhere in Britain. And the first thing that happens is they're given 65 bits of kit, not including their weapon. And they're told, you know, you go and sleep in that bunk bed over there. And, you know, tomorrow it starts. So it's a real shock to the system. And, you know, certainly when I was watching them on training how to storm buildings, you know, some of them were young and fit, some of them were, you know, maybe not so young and not so fit, but they all were doing as they were told. And what was really interesting is the number of Ukrainian interpreters there, and it was the Royal Scots who were training them, and these NCOs with thick Glaswegian accents, and the Ukrainian interpreters, how they managed to, you know, translate into Ukrainian, when you feel a squeeze on the back, have an attack at the crack, you know, and it was, that's, you know, code for not rudeness, but, get, you know, storm through an open door, an aperture. And of course, it was, you know, the air was blue with Glaswegian expletives. And I don't speak Ukrainian, so I don't know how much that was being translated. But certainly you felt there was, you know, some of the guys I saw had already been on the front line. So they were doing a kind of senior NCOs training. And what was interesting about them and talking to some of the British NCOs afterwards was that, you know, when you're training a British recruit, you got to get him off his phone, right? It's the normal look at his phone during a lecture, during a talk, you know, blah, blah, blah. He said, these guys, they don't look at their phones. You know, they listen to every word because they've been on the front line and they know that everything they're being taught, they're going to need, you know, in a matter of days, perhaps. So it was really fascinating seeing them up close and actually seeing, you know, we watched for 3 hours them training how to storm one particular building. And, you know, watching it actually got quite boring, but it was like watching, you know, training for ballet or something, the nearest equivalent. You know, you've got a squad of four. Where do you all go? Where do you put your feet? Where do you touch the guy on the back? Where do you point your weapon? How do you spin around? How do you pivot? You know, it is balletic and you've got to get it, that muscle memory going. And these people are being taught a lot in 5 weeks. It's battlefield admin, how to look after yourself on a battlefield, how to keep clean in a trench, how to deal with someone, you know, who's yelling in pain, you know, combat medicine. It's a lot to learn. The average British infantry soldier gets 12 to 18 weeks. These guys are doing it in 5 and they're doing it from, you know, jump start.
I thought you were going to say there for a moment, I don't speak Glaswegian.
Patrick. No, I don't.
But just you mentioned earlier on women. Were there any women in this contingent?
There were certainly a few women in the contingent I saw in the UK. And to go on to my sort of second sort of interaction with the Ukrainians last week was when I was with my friend crossing the border from Poland into Ukraine. So we had deposited our medical kit in unnamed town in unnamed building. And we then decided that we would have it was the second anniversary of the war. And we thought we should go and have a drink in a town on the other side of the border. And as we were walking across the border, and at the time, the Polish farmers were blockading it because they're moaning about the fact the Polish government's buying Ukrainian grain very cheaply. So as a result, the Ukrainians who are coming back from Britain couldn't be bussed across the border. They had to walk across the border because they're flown into Poland and then they normally are driven into Ukraine. But here they're driven up to the border, then they walk across the border. And you remember those 65 bits of kit I told you about? Well, they all have them. And that kit weighs a lot. There is no way, basically, one man can realistically lift all that kit and walk more than about 50 feet because it's just too much. It's too heavy. But these guys are struggling across, and I'm not patting myself on the head by saying, you know, me and my friend Simon, we decided that we would help them. And he helped a chap carry his kit, and I helped a young woman carry her kit, a young woman called Nika, N-I-K-A. And she spoke okay English, and she was telling me that she had, you know, joined up, volunteered. She was, you know, absolutely ready to do a bit. And she was very grateful that a Brit was helping her carry her stuff. But, you know, she, again, they all looked determined but tired. They'd had a 5-week training program, you know, at the hands of the Brits, and which they said was brilliant. And she said that to me unbidden. She said, you know, I really feel confident that I know how to handle myself. She said there was no way I could have handled myself on a battlefield 5 weeks ago. But she says, now I feel that I know what I'm doing. You know, obviously nothing can prepare me, she said. But at the same time, I feel, you know, that bit more confident. I'm not just going in this completely raw. You know, I'm fully prepared for what to do. And, you know, as I say, they weren't kind of joshing and laughing in the way that you would expect, you know, your average bunch of British squaddies to be doing, because these are young people who know when they get in that bus on the other side of the border, and we could see all this whole line of coaches sitting there by all the kind of duty-free shops. You know, that was their one-way ticket up to the front. You know, they weren't going home for a long time.
Great stuff, Guy. Thanks so much for that.
Brilliant stuff. We're very grateful and good luck to you.
Thank you.
Well, that was fascinating. Both Guy's visit to Operation Interflex, where Ukrainian recruits are training, and also his recent Mercy trip to Ukraine. And interesting, too, that both of those recent trips intersected when he got across the border. And just a quick reminder that if you haven't listened to it already, do go back and give Guy Walter's contribution on The Great Escape, which is part of our Battleground 44 series. Give it a listen. It's absolutely fascinating.
Yeah, this is, of course, The Great Escape, when a huge number of RAF, well, not RAF, they were Allied airmen who were stuck in Stalag Luft 3, prisoner of war camp, deep in Germany, tunneled out this amazingly epic attempt to launch a mass breakout from the prisoner of war camp. It's absolutely gripping. Do go and have a listen. Anyway, on to listeners' questions. Now, the first one comes from Carsten Hetland in Copenhagen, who says, thank you for an engaging podcast. He says, in 2021, the USA signed a defense cooperation agreement with Norway. Later in 2023, it signed a similar accord with Sweden, Finland, and Denmark. These agreements underscore the shared commitment by the US and these Northern European partners to bolster European and transatlantic security. Now, he wants to know, what do these bilateral agreements actually mean within the framework of NATO, or in a changed NATO scenario, i.e. with the US stepping back or indeed leaving NATO, what would that mean for NATO's Article 5 commitments? What do you know about this, Saul?
Well, given that the latest one with Norway has just been updated, and there are similar accords, as Carsten says, with Sweden, Finland, and Denmark, I think it's all very encouraging, actually, Patrick. What these agreements are effectively doing are providing bases for US forces, probably planes, but also military bases for soldiers on the ground to train. And it's effectively tying Scandinavia ever more tightly into a US-led kind of umbrella, really, a defensive umbrella over Western Europe. So, of course, it will operate within the context of NATO too, not least because Sweden's just joined NATO. But it's separate to that. And it's encouraging because it means that the United States, out with any change in president at the end of the year, has these military commitments going forward.
A technical one here from Mark Hamilton. I was wondering why it appears, asks Mark, that flamethrowers have not been used in Ukraine. They were relatively effective in attacking and flushing out defenders from defensive positions such as blockhouses and trenches in World War One, World War Two, and Vietnam. Yeah, we've all seen those horrific images, haven't we, of flamethrower carriers going in, hosing fire into bunkers and foxholes and things, and men seeing soldiers, you know, burst out of these positions covered in flames, you know, obviously dying an agonizing death. It seems to me that there must have been some sort of convention banning them. Is that right, Saul?
Well, they were used extensively in the Pacific War, as I cover in my book, Devil Dogs. I mean, an absolutely horrific method of war. Quite useful if you can control the ground close to whatever strong point you're trying to winkle the enemy out of. But as you say, Patrick, a horrific way to die. I mean, not outlawed under international law per se, although there have been various kind of charges against it, suggesting that this was not the sort of warfare that's acceptable. But I suspect the reason they're not being used in Ukraine is not because it's perceived to be sort of an immoral way to fight, just because it's pretty cumbersome. And now that we've got drones really spotting everything that's going on a battlefield, a guy carrying a tank and the apparatus that they use for flamethrowers is a pretty cumbersome beast, frankly. And he would be picked off pretty quickly. Certainly, I think we can be pretty certain that the Russians would be using these if they thought that they would be effective. The idea that, you know, they're considered to be infra-dig in modern warfare wouldn't bother them in the slightest.
No, I think that's absolutely right. I'm just going to read out this one from Ola Stokken in Trondheim, Norway. I know Trondheim is a fabulous city. Anyway, he's an ex-lieutenant and returned weekend warrior in the Norwegian Home Guard. Good for you. He says, thanks for the great podcast. It's the best way of keeping up to date with news and analysis in this horrific war. Thank God that we can always trust you Brits when our own media fails to report. Oh, well, that's good to hear. Now, he's just making a good point, I think, about the age of soldiers, which we were talking about last week. And one of our contributors suggested that the failed offensive of last summer, we've got to accept, would have worked better if the age of the soldiers had been younger. He says, I don't think it would have had any effect. Most of us get wiser with age, call it street smart, But a good mix in age is the best of both worlds. That's probably right, wouldn't you say, Saul, from even in the Second World War, where the average age of soldiers was very young, and indeed senior officers were startlingly young by today's standards. Nonetheless, there were quite a lot of sort of grey hairs and, you know, seasoned warriors at the top directing things.
You do need a mix, but what, as we discussed last week, Patrick, what you don't have is the mix in terms of the younger guys in Ukraine. The slightly ballsier. We don't really have a sense of our own mortality, and that probably is making a slight difference. It's also an issue, as I said before, of fairness. There is a suggestion actually that Ukraine's about to lower its recruitment age to 25 from 27 currently. That'll make a little bit of a difference, but it really needs to come way further down from that, I think. Okay, we've got a contribution here from Bruce in California, and he writes, after Macron's saber-rattling, you were so correct to point out the lackluster French contributions to Ukraine. I was also reminded of a funny quote from Jed Babin, the former US Deputy Undersecretary of Defense, who said, you know, frankly, going to war without France is like going deer hunting without an accordion. You just leave a lot of useless, noisy baggage behind. Please keep up the good work.
Well, look, I'm a Francophile, but I can see why that is actually quite funny. And indeed, if you just look at the relationship between the Brits and the French, both in the First World War and the Second World War, there's an enormous amount of arguing going on. You know, the Brits just don't get the French, and the French just don't get the Brits. So, you know, a huge amount of energy goes into dealing. And I think the Brits would say it was more, the fault was more on the French side than on their side. And there's a lot of kind of amour propre that has to be stroked, egos that have to be massaged. So, when they actually get down to it, they have proved extremely effective. Down the years, the French as a fighting force, but an awful lot of diplomacy, I think, is involved in actually getting yourself into battle.
We've got one from Keith in Ireland. He writes, love the podcast. I've been listening from show one. Please answer, why are the Republicans in the US not providing funding to Ukraine? Putin is in bed with Iran, China, and North Korea, America's three top opponents. I understand the Trump rubbish, but this is insane. So, Patrick, what's the answer to that?
Well, the strange thing is, Keith, that it's not actually, you know, it's not all the Republicans who are causing trouble here. You know, a lot of Republicans actually support Ukraine. And I think the fault really lies, at least partly, in the vagaries of US democracy. It's a sclerotic system. I mean, you know, the four-year presidential terms, the sort of constant electioneering, not least to say that there's a system that throws up the two candidates that look like they will almost certainly be fighting the election on November the 5th. But basically, the system requires large majorities for even routine legislation to be passed, which means that, you know, 40 out of 100 senators can block anything they don't like. So what we're seeing over Ukraine seems to me to be profoundly undemocratic. And the truth is that there's a majority of members, both in the House and in the Senate, as well as a large chunk of public opinion, that supports the proposed military aid package to Ukraine. But it's being blocked by a diehard bunch of Republicans who are opposed not only to sending weapons to Ukraine, but to any bipartisan deal involving the Democrats, which again completely contradicts the spirit of democracy to my eyes.
Yeah, and more importantly, Patrick, in the House of Representatives, which is currently holding up the support for Ukraine, which has been passed by the Senate, the issue is that those Republicans who do not support Ukraine have actually got control of the sort of, you know, the methods by which these votes actually come about. So if the Speaker doesn't want a vote to take place, he can, you know, hold it up. And that apparently is what's happening. I was speaking to an American about this yesterday. As you say, Patrick, the House, if they were allowed to vote, would almost certainly vote in favor of support for Ukraine. But it's not actually coming to a vote because of those Republicans, including the leader, who are standing in its way. So as you say, it seems very undemocratic, and probably you would hope or might hope would lead to some kind of reform after this situation, but maybe that's being a bit optimistic.
Okay, that's enough from us. Do join us on Wednesday for another cracking episode of Battleground 44. And of course, as usual on Friday, when we'll be digging into all that's going on in and around Ukrainian war. Goodbye.